Hello, and welcome to this Deloitte I4S podcast. My name is Randall Sokoloff, and I lead Deloitte's Global I4S Communications Group. The aim of these podcasts is to keep you up to date with I4S developments and the challenges they may bring. With me to discuss the recently issued amendments to IS 32 relating to offsetting of financial assets and financial liabilities is Andrew Spooner, who leads Deloitte's Global Financial Instruments team. But first, the customary disclaimer. I should stress that the views expressed in this podcast are personal views and are not necessarily those of Deloitte. So before we jump into the details, let me provide you some background on the project. The International Accounting Standards Board and the U.S. Financial Accounting Standards Board, the FASB, undertook a joint project to address the differences in their respective accounting standards regarding the offsetting of financial instruments. Now, back in January of this year, the boards published a converged set of proposals, and the proposals would have required an entity to offset recognized financial assets and financial liabilities when an entity has an unconditional and legally enforceable right of set-off, and also intends to settle the financial asset and financial liability on a net basis or realize them simultaneously. Now, in the big scheme of things, the proposals would have significantly changed the U.S. GAAP requirements, but the changes to current I4S would have been pretty minimal. And as the two boards went through their redeliberations on the proposals, they received a number of comment letters. The Financial Accounting Standards Board decided not to move forward with the proposals during redeliberations after a lot of discussion. And I know, Andrew, you've been following that discussion a lot. And can you tell us a little bit about the redeliberations and why the FASB decided not to ultimately converge with I4S?
Yes, thanks, Randall. I think certainly from the US perspective, if they were to move to the ISB and the FASB's proposals as set out in the ED, this would have been certainly the greatest change would have been to US GAAP as opposed to IFRS. I think at the heart of the discussion was whether conditional offsetting is acceptable to offset on the balance sheet. And what I mean by this is if you have, you know, two or more parties with an asset liability, can they offset them on the balance sheet when the setting off of cash flows is conditional? So it's not actually possible all of the time. And a lot of the focus on conditional offsetting was whether in cases where the offset only happens in bankruptcy or the event of default. Now, the reason this is important is because a lot of master netting agreements, which are, you know, operate throughout the world, do have the instance of setting off cash flows, but only in certain events. Now, currently, US GAAP has an exception that allows offsetting in these cases, but IFRS does not. So the US treatment, if they were to move to the proposals, would be a lot more significant. Now, one of the debates was really, what is the balance sheet trying to represent, which sounds like an easy question, but proved very hard to get agreement on. Now, not allowing offset for contingent set-off arrangements really is in many ways showing the market risk on the balance sheet of all your assets and liabilities. And I think the ISB felt strongly, as is currently required in the current IS 32, that you really shouldn't be allowed to offset in instances where the intention is not to offset. And because you don't intend to go into bankruptcy or intend to default you or the counterparties, then it would be inappropriate to actually offset in those circumstances. Whereas I guess the view of the FASB, which ended up prevailing, was they were saying it was kind of meaningful to show a net position because this showed the net credit risk. So you could argue that this was a bit of a debate about showing the market risk and showing the credit risk. Now, information needs of users were different. For example, debt analysts were more interested in credit risk information. Equity analysts may be more focused on market risk, but certainly interested in credit risk information as well. So there's really, a debate. If they couldn't get agreement on the balance sheet offset requirements, then could they get agreement on disclosures? And if they could get agreement on disclosures, then would there be sufficient information for people to reconcile the two different gaps?
So, Andrew, the ISB had a decision to make as a result of the FASB's decision not to move forward with the proposals. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, they had to decide really which way they were going to go, because the balance sheet requirement is very similar in the proposals to what they already have. So, of course, they could have walked away from the project and done nothing. I guess what was clear, though, is that the information needs of users was still paramount, and therefore they decided to go down this route of at least getting convergence on disclosures where they could. I mean, one other thing that was quite informative for the ISB was, even if they could get there on disclosures, through having this project, they got a lot of feedback on the current IS32, which I think maybe is not something they were expecting. And what they actually found is there were potentially differences in application of IS32, misunderstandings perhaps, or different views on how IS32 is applied in practice. And therefore, they took on those issues, debated them, and agreed that it would make sense to amend IS32, not only to make sure that they have these new offsetting disclosures, but also to take on some of the clarifications and remove some of the inconsistencies that already exist.
Okay, well, let's talk about the amendments themselves. And there are really two pieces to the amendments: the new disclosure requirements, which you just mentioned, and certain clarifications to the existing IFRS offsetting rules. So I want to first discuss the disclosures. The board has said the objective of the disclosures is so users of financial statements could really better evaluate the effect of set-off rights and other types of arrangements, such as collateral arrangements, on an entity's financial position. And as a result of that, entities are going to need to disclose a number of items in a tabular format separating financial assets and financial items or financial liabilities. And I'm going to just walk through those just very quickly. The first thing is that companies are going to have to disclose the gross amounts of recognized financial assets and financial liabilities under an enforceable master netting agreement or a similar type of arrangement. They'll have to disclose the amounts offset in accordance with the criteria in IS32. They'll disclose the net amounts presented in the statement of financial position, and the amounts related to enforceable rights of set-off for instruments in the scope of the disclosures that do not meet the criteria in IS32, and finally, the net amounts after taking into account all the items I just mentioned. So those are really a quick list of the required disclosures. So now that I've gone through those disclosures, Andrew, is there really anything you want to point out in particular?
Well, the disclosures are intended to be quite broad, so they will be capturing enforceable rights of set-off. Now, clearly, we want to reconcile the differences between IFRS and US accounting. So the enforceable right of set-offs doesn't necessarily mean offset. And I guess that's the whole point, that what we're trying to do is capture these arrangements where set-off may be possible and ensure they get captured within the disclosure tables. Now, the disclosure tables will therefore show where offset is achieved. In fact, we'll kind of gross that up to show the degree of offset that has actually been achieved on the balance sheet. It will then take those numbers and then show how these other arrangements where, for example, collateral might be posted, where there has not been offset, and also show those. So the whole table really have a complete picture of where you've had offset on the balance sheet and where you've not had offset on the balance sheet with these enforceable rights of set-off. Now, let me give you an example. An example would be if you had, say, a derivative asset and a derivative liability. Now, let's assume these were under an ISDA master netting agreement. Now, under IS32, you couldn't get offset. So you would show those gross amounts per the balance sheet in the table. Now, imagine that you were in a position where you had an asset and a liability, and the asset was bigger than the liability. Now, in that example, the other party might post some collateral to you. Now, when you get that collateral, you obviously record it on your balance sheet and record an obligation to return it. Now, what the table tries to do is also capture that. So although there hasn't been offset even for the collateral versus the asset and liability, that will get included in the table so you can show the degree to which credit risk is mitigated because of the offsetting arrangement. Now, another issue is over-collateralization. And I mention this because in instances where collateral is pledged or received, sometimes it can be less or more than the exposure. Now, in the case where it's less, that's quite informative because the entity has an exposure even after taking into account the collateral. Now, where they get more collateral than the exposure they have, the table tries to avoid a problem where you might add up all the overs and the unders and effectively imply a different credit risk picture than is actually evident in practice. I mean, for example, if I had an asset of 100 and a liability of 90, then I'm exposed by 10, and that is under-collateralized. Now, if I had a similar arrangement with an asset of 20 and a liability of 30, equally there's 10, but it's 10 going the other way. I'm over-collateralized in that instance. Now, if you were to add all those up, you'd end up adding up to zero, and that would give the impression that you had no risk, when in fact you still have risk because you have a net asset of 10. So they've tried to overcome this by having specific requirements of how we deal with over-collateralization. The other thing that they try and do is also allow some flexibility about the way you actually describe things in the table. And this really is a question about aggregation. How do you get all this information included in the table? Now, what they allow you to do is either do some of the disclosures by counterparty or otherwise aggregate in terms of type. Now, what I mean by this is you could aggregate all your derivatives or your repos or your reverse repos. And what you're doing there is aggregating them to show how the offset is being achieved on the balance sheet or is not. When you've got those collateral disclosures or those other credit risk mitigants, you can either disclose those by type, so carry on the type disclosures, or you can do it by counterparty. What you don't need to do, however, is you don't need to actually say who the counterparties are. But if you have individually significant counterparties, then they need to kind of separately be identified on a no-names basis.
Andrew, I know that preparers were pretty concerned about the cost of providing disclosures by class of instrument. So it seems like the flexibility that the board has provided should alleviate these concerns.
Yeah, I mean, certainly financial statement preparers were concerned with the cost compared with the incremental benefit of doing this requirement, particularly where offset is not achieved on the balance sheet. Now, they indicated that they manage credit risk exposure by counterparties rather than by class, and therefore requiring disclosure by class would in some cases be burdensome. Now, financial statement users were indifferent as to whether they received it by class or by counterparty, as long as it could be reconciled back to the amounts included in the statement of financial position. Therefore, the boards decided to provide some flexibility how to present the disclosures.
Okay, now let's move on to the actual amendments to IAS 32. And as we mentioned earlier, the proposals in the ED were really viewed as very similar to the current requirements in IAS 32. There were some subtle differences that could have significantly changed the application of the offsetting requirements. Additionally, while conducting outreach, the ISB staff had observed differing interpretations and application of the current offsetting requirements and how those proposals in the exposure draft may have changed existing practice under IAS 32. And there are a number of concerns that we could bucket. The first meaning, the meaning of the term currently as legally enforceable right of set-off. The next area of concern was the application of simultaneously realizing and settlement. The next is the offsetting of collateral amounts. And the fourth bucket is the unit of account for applying the offsetting requirements. Now, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, the ISB decided not to finalize the proposals in the E&D and instead retain the existing offsetting requirements in paragraph 42 of IAS 32. And just as a reminder, what paragraph 42 says is that a financial asset and a financial liability is offset only when an entity currently has a legally enforceable right to set off the recognized amounts and intends either to settle on a net basis or to realize the asset and settle the liability simultaneously. However, the board has included additional clarifying guidance to address some of the above issues that I had mentioned. And Andrew, if you could walk us through some of those clarifications to help the listeners really understand what these clarifications are to the existing IAS 32 guidance.
Well, starting from the top of that list was the meaning of this term currently has a legal enforceable right of set-off. Now, the ISB has included some additional application guidance on what that means. Now, that guidance clarifies that to set off a financial asset and a financial liability, the right must be available today rather than being contingent on a future event, and must be exercisable by any of the counterparties, both in the normal course of business as well as in the event of default, insolvency or bankruptcy. So it's clearly a very high hurdle. Now, the guidance also clarifies that the right may arise either because of a provision in law or regulation or from a contract. Now, as a result, the determination of whether the rights meet the legally enforceable criterion will depend on both the contractual terms entered in between the counterparties as well as the law governing the contract and the bankruptcy process in the event of bankruptcy or insolvency. Now, this will clearly depend on the jurisdictional law. Now, an observation, some have observed that IS 32 only required a right of set-off in the normal course of business without necessarily thinking about all those events such as bankruptcy, insolvency, default. Now, specifically requiring consideration of these events may result in entities having to reconsider their existing arrangements to determine whether items currently being offset would still qualify under the amended guidance. I mean, further, IS 32 has been interpreted by some to only consider the counterparty when considering all the related, all the parties, rather than the actual reporting entity itself. Now, the clarifying guidance may also result in the need then to reassess your existing arrangements, including potentially obtaining your revised legal opinions, should the entity have taken a different view on IS 32 than is now being clarified. Now, the second issue that you mentioned, Randall, was the issue of simultaneous settlement. Now, the ISB has added some guidance on what simultaneous settlement means. Specifically, they've added guidance on the kind of settlement processes which are acceptable in order to get offsetting. Now, the guidance specifies that realization of a financial asset and settlement of financial liability is simultaneous only if they occur at the same moment. Now, on the face of it, this isn't different to the language we had in the, I guess, in the current IS 32. However, the guidance does provide that gross settlement does not occur simultaneously, may meet the principle if the criteria for offset is a single settlement process and it results in the cash flows being equivalent to a single net amount. Now, specifically, the gross settlement system would meet the criteria for net settlement if it has all the following criteria. And I'll go through those criteria, and they're quite lengthy. I mean, the first one is that the asset and liability must meet the right of set-off criterion, and they're submitted for processing at exactly the same time. So there's a single kind of processing of which the asset and liability is submitted. Secondly, the financial asset and liability have the same kind of settlements instructions, and once they've started, they can't be cancelled or altered. Now, thirdly, there's got to be no potential for the cash flows arising from the asset and liability to change once they've been submitted. So in many ways, they're kind of fixed. Fourthly, if the processing of the one of the asset or liability that is offset against another fails, then the processing of the related security user's collateral also fails. So, for example, a securities transfer system or delivery versus payment. Fifthly, a settlement of the amount due and payable is carried out through the same settlement depository, for example, delivery versus payments, etc. And lastly, there exists an intraday credit facility that will provide sufficient overdraft or other intraday credit at the settlement date for each of the parties. And there is a high likelihood that the intraday credit facility would be honoured if it was called upon. So there's not a kind of probability of default that the credit facility wouldn't stand. Now, the reason the ISB went into so much detail in their application guidance is that the ISB acknowledged that from their outreach activities that they identified there was diversity regarding the interpretation of simultaneous settlement in IS 32. I mean, many viewed the use of a clearinghouse as always meeting the simultaneous settlement. In many ways, they were relying on the processes of the clearinghouse to kind of pass the test. Others analogize with US GAAP on repurchase and reverse repurchase agreements in topic 210 in assessing whether something was net or simultaneous settlement. Now, some also argued that exchanging cash flows at exactly the same moment was not operational and ignored the settlement systems designed to achieve the same economic equivalent net exposure. Now, the board ultimately agreed that certain gross settlement systems may meet the definition of net settlement and therefore have included this additional guidance. Now, one of the other issues you mentioned, Randall, was the issue of offsetting of collateral. Now, the ED proposed a prohibition on offsetting assets pledged as collateral and the obligation to return collateral obtained against any associated asset or liability. Now, many comment letters objected to this approach. I guess they really didn't see the difference between a financial liability, say, to return collateral than any other financial liability. And the view that they took, and this was common with a lot of financial institutions and clearinghouses, was if the collateral financial liability met the offsetting criteria, then it should be offset. So there shouldn't be any, special rules for collateral. Lastly, the unit of account guidance in IAS 32, some argue, wasn't clear. And what I mean by this is whether you can actually offset part of an asset or liability. So, for example, half of an asset or liability. Similarly, could you offset specified cash flows, for example, a specific cash flow in an asset or a specific cash flow in a liability? And now many comment letters requested for clarification on this unit of account guidance. Now, the ISB recognised there was some diversity in current application of IAS 32. In certain industries, such as utilities and energy and resources companies, applying the offset guidance to identifiable cash flows was fairly pervasive. And where, when you compare with the financial services sector, they were applying the guidance basically on whole assets, simply because of the volume of derivative transactions that were being entered into. Now, the board acknowledged that presenting the net individual cash flows may be conceptually preferable in order to reflect an entity's expected cash flows. However, the board had concern about piercing the unit of account, as it may require or permit overrides to the measurement basis in IAS 39 or IFRS 9. They also had a concern with forcing such an approach on financial institutions that could experience difficult operational challenges in complying with the requirements. Conversely, the boards had concerns with specifying the unit of account at the individual financial instrument level, as this would preclude some entities who currently are offsetting identifiable cash flows from doing so. So when the board looked at this, they agreed not to really clarify the unit of account in the amendments.
Great. So let me just spend the last few minutes talking about the effective dates of the amendments. The ISB had originally decided that the effective date of January 1st, 2013 for both the disclosures and clarifying amendments was the most appropriate effective date. However, they did get some constituent feedback which raised certain concerns, more around operational concerns, with the clarifying amendments to IAS 32. In particular, they were concerned about the requirement to provide comparative information as of January 1st, 2012, and the fact that many of their contractual arrangements will have to be reconsidered, and there's going to be system implications which they're going to have to deal with as well. So based on these concerns, the ISB decided to actually delay the effective date of the clarifying amendments to annual periods beginning on or after January 1st, 2014. Now, the offsetting disclosure requirements are going to be effective for annual periods beginning on or after January 1st, 2013. The disclosures and amendments need to be provided retrospectively to all comparative periods. So just keep in mind there are differences in the effective dates for both the clarifying amendments and the disclosures. Okay, Andrew, any last thoughts before we wrap up the podcast?
Randall, there's a few points that's probably worth mentioning. I suppose the kind of overall observation is that there is a bit of a risk here with current IFRS reporters that they pay less attention to this amendment than perhaps they should. And I guess partly because people would think that the IAS 32 requirements haven't really changed. I suppose the first point is that the new disclosure requirements are beyond what most reporters currently disclose. So in cases where offset is not achieved, which of course is pretty common in IAS 32 because offset is actually harder to achieve than, say, in US GAAP, then there will be obviously a need to source all the data for all these contingent set-off arrangements where offset is not achieved, and this could actually be quite significant in terms of data management. This is particularly so because, as a result of the financial crisis, financial institutions and corporates are increasingly demanding collateral to be provided for their derivative positions. So the disclosure table that really reflects the credit risk through these credit risk mitigant arrangements is going to be pretty important. Now, although the principle in offset under IAS 32 has not changed, the application guidance clearly has, and we've talked about that. I suppose one thing to focus on is the simultaneous settlement. And this is increasingly relevant as there is a push for more derivative positions to be executed through clearinghouses. Also, it's worth preparers thinking again about the collateral offsetting, the unit of account, and their legal rights of offset in all circumstances to see whether their existing interpretations of IAS 32 still hold.
Great, Andrew, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today, but please look out for more of these podcasts in the coming weeks. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.